Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
In America, newlyweds look forward to starting a small business, while parents hope that their children will be even better off. This American dream works for a lot of people. Not for everybody, of course, but for enough people that it has become not only a political and economic cry, but has increasingly shaped the whole American culture. This is the third part in our series on the American religion, and tonight's subject is consumerism. Selling God. Historian Jackson Lears reports that, quote, to thrive and spread, a consumer culture required more than a national apparatus of marketing and distribution. It also needed a favorable moral climate. In other words, part of the success of America's fabulous selling machine is due to the spiritual and moral world in which it was born. Now, before we salute ourselves for giving birth to American success, let's not forget what Lears is saying here. It's one thing to have consumers and quite another to live in a consumer culture. The factors that made America a great producer nation, thrift, savings, industry, traits that are often identified as the so-called Protestant work ethic, were increasingly undermined not only by the revivalism that undercut sound theology, but by the emerging forces of the modern world. Instead of producers, Americans became consumers. Leading the world in new products and services, we now have become the largest debtor nation in the world. And where are we spending all this money? On entertainment, goods and services that offer therapeutic satisfaction. And that's why New York University professor Neil Postman says Americans are amusing themselves to death. And that includes religion. In fact, religion is often the first package to be marketed. That's the way it was even in the very beginning. You remember Eve's rationale for eating the forbidden fruit. When she saw that the tree was beautiful to the eyes and desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate. In other words, the packaging was all there. It was attractive, and it promised something that Eve really thought she simply couldn't live without. In fact, denying herself this treasure was so unthinkable that she would even risk her soul. Today, however, this religion is called appealing to felt needs. The assumption is that we're all born into this world consumers rather than enemies of God. After all, doesn't the bumper sticker say, born to shop? So, an essential part of the American religion that is now exported around the world is religious consumerism. We see this especially at home, where we talk about being church families, but watch people join and leave about as frequently as if it were a health club. Most don't even join, but that's okay, we're told, because that's just the way boomers are. Our mamas told us we'd better shop around. And now we consume everything. As David Wells has observed, we consume relationships, we consume our experiences, and we even consume God, or try. Instead of losing our religion, perhaps our lead song could be Consuming My Religion. And this is an important difference, for to approach God as sinners in need of reconciliation is quite different from approaching Him as consumers in need of a new fix. Having been raised in mainstream conservative Christianity in America myself, I recall countless testimonies from people who had either been recently converted or had rededicated their lives after wandering for a while. Not unlike a diet plan, there were the before and after shots of the person. Before, they used to do bad things, but now they do good things. Before, they used to be unhappy, but now they are happy in Jesus all the time. Before, they were in debt and unemployed, but now they live a successful life. Now, please hear what I'm saying and not saying. I'm not saying we should ignore the wonderful promises in Scripture guaranteeing new life in Christ. Nor am I saying that this new life that often secures many wonderful immediate changes in one's outlook, attitude, and lifestyle, shouldn't be explained to unbelievers as a great benefit of Christ's atoning death. He not only takes away the guilt, but the tyranny of our sin. Many addicted to drugs and alcohol have been released from even the temptation to go back to their slavery. Many have been so suddenly converted that they immediately lost a desire for promiscuous relationships and found a wife for life. And these examples ought to be occasions for great joy. But in a consumer culture, they become promises in a commercial for a product rather than examples of God's saving grace. And what happens when the marriage that you expected to be fixed by becoming a Christian falls apart? What happens when after an initial 3 weeks of blissful relief you find yourself on the streets again looking for a fix or in your room cradling a bottle of cheap bourbon you've just emptied? Well, we know what happens when products don't satisfy our consumer demands. We find another one. Bumper stickers like "Try God" or "Give Jesus a Chance" sound like the money-back guarantee on a tube of toothpaste. And if your teeth aren't whiter and brighter, simply return the unused portion for a full refund. And in America especially, where we're pampered by goods and services that appeal to our selfishness and greed, we are very good at coming up with the most trivial problems and treating them as if they were the end of the world. My worst problem I face is not that I'm having a bad hair day. You see, all of this fails to come to grips with the reality of our problem and God's solution. In other words, it's impossible to have the biblical gospel and deal with the biblical God if we're looking for answers to problems that somehow are more important than the one addressed by that gospel announcement. If our greatest problem is a lack of fulfillment or self-esteem, broken relationships, child-rearing, national morality, whatever, then the gospel can only be an answer to these felt needs. But if our greatest problem is that we're enemies of God from birth, helpless to save ourselves, stripped of all righteousness and covered with guilt from top to bottom, under the eternal wrath of God, then the gospel finally makes sense. The bad news may be worse than we ever imagined, but the good news is that much better. Our felt needs, you see, are consumer needs, and they're utterly trivial. If God said, "Okay, I'll fix three things in your life, tell me your three wishes," we'd undoubtedly pick the dumbest things. Our felt needs are shaped by our sinful nature that doesn't really know what the real problem is. But God demands the right to tell us what our real needs are. Our real issue is that we are sinners in need of God's favor, not that we are consumers in need of a new product. Ken Jones is sitting in for Kim Riddlebarger, who is off on a well-deserved vacation. He is on his way, as we speak, to Mammoth, I'm sure. And the Reverend Ken Jones is pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church. And our usual dad Rod, Dr. Rod Rosenblatt. You haven't heard that in a while. And I'm Michael Horton, and it's great to be with you again on the White Horse Inn tonight. This is part three in a series on the American religion. Tonight we're talking about consumerism. What does it mean to be selling God? An article in the Los Angeles Times came out September 24th of last year, just after a major trade convention. From bird feeders to Bible games, religious retailing is a $3 billion business. Some see it as a way to express identity. Critics question the spirit behind the products. Mm. Whether we're talking about your local Christian bookstore, which is no longer called a bookstore, but a gift shop, because there are more trinkets there than books.
Yeah, they just happen to have a few books on the side, yeah.
Yeah, or whether you're talking about the decisions about what a church will look like and the sermons that are preached and the form of worship that is there. Have we adopted in the church today a consumer orientation that really means that we're selling God to consumers rather than proclaiming God to sinners?
Yeah, it wasn't in this case by any large immediate bureaucratic decision. We've drifted into that one, but everybody knows it if they think about it for a moment. On the streets, you're choosing a church, and many times the categories for choosing the church you'll attend are consumer categories.
Mm.
And the pastor is the marketing manager.
Well, R.C. Sproul says that, it used to be sinners in the hands of an angry God, Jonathan Edwards' famous sermon from the Great Awakening. But today, he says, it's God in the hands of angry sinners. Mm-hmm. Does consumerism turn the tables, if you will, instead of us being at the bar of God's judgment, it makes God somehow beholden to us. Now, instead of the real problem being, I'm a sinner under the wrath of God, it's I'm an unsatisfied consumer who needs to be convinced that this is a product I should buy.
Yeah, I think the categories fit what's going on today. And it makes it very, very difficult, as you mentioned in your opening commentary, to see things in a biblical way. One of the ways in which our intellect gets blurred by sin, trivial as this is, it still can be something where a person avoids hearing the saving gospel.
So even if we have sound doctrine that we subscribe to on a piece of paper somewhere, if we are looking at our ministry as a marketing manager or a salesperson looks at his profession, we're coming at it in a way that will completely undermine whatever we profess to believe.
Yeah, and ironically, that used to be how the evangelical criticized liberalism. That is, that there were tremendous forces on the liberal Protestant pastor to adjust his message so that it would not confront the culture at every point, and we would, the evangelical would slam away at how non-eternal that was. And if we take a look at the evangelical movement today, what exactly is the difference between what we were slamming in liberalism before mm-hmm. and what we're doing today?
Yeah, the National Council of Churches used to have the slogan, the world sets the church's agenda. And I wonder how different that is from George Barna, a leading church growth expert, writing that the most important aspect of Christian communication is to realize that the audience, not the message, is sovereign.
Well, and to go back to what you said earlier about the tables being turned, what we find is rather than the righteousness of God or God being satisfied, the satisfaction of a holy and just God, we are attempting to satisfy the desires and the appetites of an ungodly people.
Does it really make a difference whether we approach God as consumers or sinners, as long as we buy Him, as long as we embrace Jesus Christ? Does it really matter how we approach Him?
Well, let me bring another one from classical Protestant liberalism. We used to criticize them for saying that belief in itself was a wonderful thing. It didn't really matter. The magic of believing. And we slammed away at liberal Protestantism that the object was what was most important, whether you grasp the true and saving object, who is Christ Himself in His atoning death on the cross, and we slammed away at it. And now we find ourselves again in evangelicalism, and what exactly is the difference?
Yeah, it's the same thing. People, as long as we have people in the building, as long as people are happy and satisfied, then what difference does it make how we got them in?
We have consumers.
Exactly.
Or here's another one.
We call them seekers, but what we really mean is they're consumers.
Here's another one. Think about this one for a moment. How would you answer this question? I think the world would be better off if there were more religion, or I think the world would be worse off if there were more religion. The reformers would have answered, I think the world would be worse off if there was more religion, because it's always man-made. And I'm wondering, in a consumer-oriented evangelicalism, how people would answer that question.
How does consumerism dominate the culture, apart from its effects on the church? How do we see it pervading the culture around us?
Well, you see it with people engaging not engaging, but purchasing things they don't need or yeah. want, but simply because they've been told they want them and they need them.
And we buy images, don't we? We
exactly.
don't buy products. We see a wonderful romantic encounter and we say, I need that. What we're really saying is, I need this experience.
I need the image. Yeah, I need the image that's being projected. That's me. Everyone sees themselves as the person that's identified in the ads and so forth. That's me. That's what I need for my identity. And it's the same thing again in the church. We need a certain type of church because it fits our image, because we have bought into the whole image type thing from Madison Avenue, as it were.
One of the things that's been a theme since at least the 1950s in America is the picture of people, what one Harvard professor called hollow men. Mm. And if you have that situation, you have the ideal situation for the marketer. Because what you can do is to promise that they will, if they will have this next experience, some of the hollowness will go away.
Isn't that what Don Henley had in the lyrics there in that song? It was a pretty big year for predators. The marketplace was on a roll, and the land of opportunity spawned a whole new breed of men without souls. You know, it reminds me of the movie Power, and here we are coming up on an election where Richard Gere is this media wizard who packages politicians.
Yep.
And some of the lines that he says, it doesn't matter who's running the show, just the show. Candidates are prepackaged, pre-digested like TV dinners. I've made a lot of money believing that. And then his whole outlook is turned upside down when he runs into a hopelessly naive candidate who refuses to conform. He says, something human came into this race, some honesty, something that wasn't slick and prepackaged, something that wasn't engineered by these media wizards. Now, do we play on people's fears or and desires?
Think of Steve Martin in Leap of Faith.
Yeah.
You're the real thing, kid. There isn't any protection when it's the real thing, and believe me, you're the real thing.
See, I get the sense, when I talk to non-Christians, they've never heard about sin and justification.
Right.
Right.
And, or many Christians. And one thing that I get from a lot of cynical people who really, you know, think that Christianity is what they see on Christian television or whatever, what I hear from a lot of them is, now, I may not like this message. This may turn me off. It may offend me. But this sounds honest. This
right.
at least
right.
sounds like what you know, might actually explain something.
Well, Mike, you were talking earlier about the effect of consumerism on in the culture at large, and I think, in especially as it's reflected in the church, just take, for instance, the new and improved concept in marketing. You just take an old product like deodorant, and you say it's new and improved.
Hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, it's done the same thing, but because it's new and improved, then people want to market it different. They want to charge prices. But now look at how this is reflected in the church. This is an advertisement that actually crossed my desk. Sermon helps and illustrations for only pennies. But look at how they advertise it. New angles on weddings, the Lord's Supper, baby dedications, and other special events.
Oh, we need new angles on all those things.
Well, Shane played the tape on selling t-shirts. Listen to this. Here's what the others are saying about Christ or whatever. It's a Christ-centered health program. But listen to this. Thanks to First Place, I'm controlling my weight with a power greater than my own.
So all you have to do is have a Christian version of whatever's out there in the world, sell it with a Bible verse and a prayer. For instance, in that LA Times article, it says, it quotes a Christian greeting card business brochure as saying, quote, early in 1973, God led us to produce 18 general occasion cards complete with three notes and a corrugated displayer. Isn't it amazing how God, having finished Genesis through Revelation, is very, I guess he doesn't have enough time. He needs to
get a life.
Get a life. And so he's taken up business. He's telling people they need corrugated displays to really make a lot of money.
Well, listen, here's one way to get people to come to your church. We're talking about marketing, right? Here's a person who was a personal friend of Elvis Presley who will share things never heard. Monday night at 7:30, he will give seven reasons why Elvis could not go to hell. Sunday night service at 6 p.m., and this is at a church in Tennessee. Now, this is how they are getting people to come to the church. Not the gospel, not the message.
These are from the door. We've got to give credit where credit is due.
Yes, the Wittenberg door.
Here is one, a church advertisement. No kidding. You can come Easter Sunday, 7 p.m. to the Miracle Bethel Pentecostal Church on Stockwell Road and hear Jimmy Maynor, who is an ex-midget.
That's great because, you know, you need to recover from that.
Right. Or here's one.
What is an ex-midget?
Here's one.
Plymouth, he grew an inch.
Plymouth Church of the Nazarene. No kidding. Real church ad. You can come to hear Hanson's Gospel Birds performing unbelievable feats, answering questions with a clear voice, swallowing a sword full length of bird's body, eating with a fork, flying backwards, opening a padlock, and riding airplanes.
All of those evangelical things that birds do.
But see, yeah. If people come, at least it's better for them to be there than to be anywhere else.
Well, you don't want a bird sitting in a cage in a bar, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, exactly.
Here again, that brings up that question. Do you think the world is better with some more religion than less?
Yeah.
And the reformers would answer that in a different way. Try this one. This is First Assembly of God. What to do if you miss the rapture? You'll not want to miss this important dramatized sermon by Pastor Blank Blank. See a simulated rapture from the front of the church. Hear the trumpet of the Lord. Experience Bible prophesied events that will take place soon.
But I've got to share this one. Now, this is an advertisement. This is a selling of sermons. Now, this thing sells you sermons. In fact, it says, add power to your preaching with relevant, expository, hard-hitting sermons. They actually sell sermon outlines.
And here, this isn't from the Wittenberg Door.
No. This actually came to me in the mail. But here's a testimonial. This challenges me to be creative. To buy sermons written,
right. Oh, that's
already
amazing.
Outlined, and right. It challenges me to be creative. This is a pastor.
Here's one more from the door. Come to the Pentecostal Church of God and hear Hillbillies for Christ. There'll be puppets, prizes, singing, and stories. And here's the subtitle. Ma and Pa and All the Young'uns.
Now, Rod, that's...
Is that in Tulsa?
There isn't a city here. How about Princess Ramona, daughter of Chief Standing Horse, presents the gospel through song and yodeling? The West Layton Assembly of God.
Oh, goodness. The offense of the cross replaced with the offense of yodeling. This is from a newspaper, an article, secular newspaper locally, New Twist to Ancient Tradition. This is a mega church in Southern California. Church sends message home with takeout communion. Now listen to this. Call it communion to go when worshipers at X Community Church file out of services this weekend. They'll leave with hearts full of hopes and hands full of plastic wrapped and hermetically sealed communion wafers and grape juice. The blank church is distributing the body and blood of Christ with a takeout style to drive home a message. Religion should be carried beyond the church doors into the community. I mean, this is...
I've got to have that for a teaching aid at Christ College. I need a little McDonald's ketchup container with grape juice in it for...
Okay, before we go to our calls, we have to remind ourselves how this came to dominate the church. Folks, Charles Finney, the evangelist of the 19th century, started all of this by getting rid of the God-centered character of Reformation preaching that had gone under the banner of the First Great Awakening. Charles Finney wanted to overturn all of that theology, put man at the center. He said, quote, "Salvation is the work of man. It consists in man's duty. We need excitement sufficient to induce men to repentance. The new birth," he said, "is not a miracle, but a philosophical result of the right use of techniques." Now, doesn't all of this really lay the groundwork for a religious consumerism? What
exactly.
effect would it have if we really believe Paul's words, "It does not depend on man's will or effort, but on God's mercy"?
Mm-hmm.
What if we really believe that? Could there be a religious consumerism if we believe that man doesn't save himself with God's help, but that God saves people through the means he has appointed when they are dead in trespasses and sins?
Well, that's why our seminaries have become nothing more than psychology centers and marketing places rather than teaching people or teaching potential pastors theology, historical Christian doctrine.
But again, it goes back to the past. D.L. Moody's Crusades, for instance,
yes.
were, and though he was better than Finney in his theology, His crusades, his revivals were funded by P.T. Barnum of Barnum and Bailey and Andrew Carnegie, who said the business of America is business. Moody said, "When I quit being a shoe salesman and became an evangelist, I didn't change jobs. I just started
change
selling
products.
A different
yeah.
product."
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then Billy Sunday came along, the baseball player turned evangelist at the turn of the century. And he claimed he was the most efficient evangelist, guaranteeing results at $2 per soul. I mean, only in America, that kind of crass consumerism. Eric Fromm in The Sane Society wrote, "Modern man, if he dared to be articulate about his concept of heaven, would describe a vision which would look like the biggest department store in the world."
Mm.
I wonder how many people would show up at our church next Sunday if I guaranteed that O.J. Simpson would be there.
Mm.
Yeah.
To confess something.
Yeah.
Anything.
Right. Tell us about Bibleopoly and the games you have here.
Bibleopoly is a game that's loosely based on Monopoly. It's in this game you build a church in a Bible city, and it takes about an hour to play as opposed to a lot longer that Monopoly would normally take. And it's basically just been made to work with a lot of the Bible cities, and much more adaptive to this market than traditional Monopoly. It's not as capitalist of a game.
And I guess if you pass Go, instead of getting $200, what do you get here?
In this game, you still get some form of monetary value when you go around. It's not really called money. It's an offering, and then you get that every time you go by in the beginning, not pass Go. So it's a little bit different than Monopoly now.
Again and again in the lyrics of secular artists, U2, "The God I Believe In Isn't Short of Cash, Mister." Mary Chapin Carpenter, "The preacher showed me the way according to him in return for my personal check. I'll take my chances. Forgiveness doesn't come with a debt." You've got Huey Lewis in the News singing about a fat man selling salvation in his hand. You've got Poison. "I see him on the TV preaching about the promised land. He tells me to believe in Jesus and steals the money from my hand." Ray Stevens, "They sell you salvation while they sing Amazing Grace." Mm. And, I mean, John Tetzel. "The Reformation started because a guy came through town selling salvation for money."
Mm-hmm.
"If you'll just contribute to the building of the world's largest cathedral in Rome, you can get Aunt Maud out a lot more quickly." Are we seeing the same thing today? Why do non-Christians notice the errant theology in all of this business, but we don't seem to?
Right.
They don't even talk about the bad hair.
Yeah.
They focus on this really serious question. Before we get to our callers, I know we've got every line full, and I want to get to you right away, but real quickly, we have a clip from a discussion we had some time ago with William Pinnell from Fuller Seminary, Richard Halverson, who was the U.S. Senate chaplain, recently passed away, Jim Boyce, the pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church, and J.I. Packer. But here's a brief clip that applies to what we're talking about tonight.
To what extent is our gospel, does it have the label "Made in America" imprinted on it? In other words, are we the packagers and the unbelievers out there, the consumers, and God the product for the big sale?
I'm always impressed with the conversation Jesus had with some of his contemporaries. He said, what can we do that we might work the works of God? The assumption apparently being that whatever God laid on them, they could do it. And Jesus said, this is the work that God requires, that you believe on him whom he hath sent. And they could no more swallow that than any other teaching that Jesus laid. That always stuck in their throats. And I think the reason for that, of course, is because that lays all the burden on God, as Brother Jim has said, to be the Savior.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, that's un-American. You see, to think that we would need someone outside ourselves to save us is in violation of the great secular spirit.
Yeah, pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, independence.
A footnote to this comment. Jesus had just fed them. And he said, "You seek me, not because you saw the sign, but because I fed you."
Mm.
And what he was saying to me was, you were so absorbed in your own consumerism, that you didn't even see the fact that I turned a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish into a meal for 5,000 plus.
Mm.
They simply missed that incredible sign because they were so preoccupied with feeding their own bellies. I think of a lay team which went with me to India a number of years ago. Now here we're sitting in a rather large Indian audience, many pastors whose salaries were perhaps $30 a month, and here we were in this great crowd of Indian Christians, and this layman got up to give his testimony, and in effect he said that because he tithed, God gave him a Cadillac. Now I wanted to disappear The antithesis of his way of expressing his faith was so totally out of place. It was just American. It was an American culture. It wasn't biblical. It wasn't even Christian.
Yeah, it's also how we approach problems in life, which I think flows from that. You see, if God is there to serve us and you're going through a difficult time, if you're suffering, if someone in your family is suffering, if God's going to mean anything, he's got to solve your problem. That means you've got to have health, so you have a holistic health type of gospel. If you're suffering financially, he's got to turn that around and give you the Cadillac or whatever else. That's what flows from that kind of man-centered religion. Now, if you take it the other way around, if we're there for God's benefit, then God has a purpose even in the suffering. Mm. And that's the meaning of Job.
Oh, that's terrific stuff. By the way, you can get that whole discussion. It is a really interesting discussion to have all of those guys together. You didn't even hear from J.I. Packer. Tremendous stuff. Dave in Barrington, New Jersey, good evening.
Hello. Yes, I had some questions here, but now that you're something occurred to me that I wanted to get your opinion on quickly. In 1980, Bob Dylan became a Christian and cut three albums that were about his born-again experience. One was Slow Train Coming, another one was Saved and Shot of Love. And then he just kind of faded back. And was this a backsliding, or was this a great big consumerism of the millennium?
Hmm. Well, personally, I think Bob Dylan bought into commercial evangelicalism, and then he realized later that he didn't have to stop making good music in order to be saved.
Well, I was sort of involved in that way back when, kind of tangentially, and my impression was, being very close to the situation, nobody bothered to catechize him.
Mm, exactly, yeah.
See, that's what we do a lot of times. This is part of the commercialism, folks. We have shallow conversions, often from people who are shallowly converted. Mm-hmm. You have your baseball and football stars and your beauty queens come in who have, you know, maybe had some seed planted, it's like the seed that is choked by the weeds, or when the sun comes up, it dies because the roots aren't deep enough. And you got to deepen those roots. Mm-hmm. And you're getting shallow conversions from shallowly converted superstars. Consumerism does not lead to
catechism.
Disciples. Yeah. Let's talk to Steve in Toms River, New Jersey. Hey, Steve.
Hi. I, too, am a former midget, but...
I am, too.
I'm a perpetual one,
Steve. That was funny. I think about, I think a lot of Christians have to learn the difference between wanting something and needing something.
Mm. Great point.
I remember trying to teach my niece the difference when she was a child, when she was younger, the difference between wanting something for Christmas and so on, you know, and needing something.
You know, Steve really brings up an important point there, because, I mean, in our culture, I have to have this. Right. I absolutely cannot live without this toothpaste or shampoo or whatever it is. Right. Well, of course we can live without a whole lot of things that we think we absolutely need. And frankly, if we think that we don't need forgiveness of sins, we don't then turn around as the church and say, well, then let's start with their felt needs. We say, well, then they need to know that their greatest problem isn't that they don't have a happy life. Their real problem is that they're under the wrath of God.
Right. Well, that's the tragedy, Mike, of the church going into the marketing business and the preachers, because the people, they are bombarded by what they want in the culture. And we have to be able to stay on track and remind them of what their real needs are, which is reconciliation before a holy God.
And when the culture's always telling you, you deserve a break today, sure it costs more, but I'm worth it.
Exactly.
Then you just take this over into the religious sphere, and it's chaos. Let's talk to Mike in North Hills, California.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
First of all, you have to publish some of those church advertisements, print them on T-shirts or something. Right?
They're probably already out there.
Okay, I have two questions here, if you can help me out. First of all, it seems that what most people today view as evangelism is merely a selling technique, which is deftly applied to something with eternal consequences. Hmm. Now, I've been told that evangelism is bringing one person one step closer to Christ, and I view this as a mild selling technique. Mm-hmm. Can you take this statement or reinterpret it differently so that it reflects true evangelism? My second question is, what literature can you recommend that correctly describes true biblical evangelism and how one correctly applies it?
Thanks, Mike.
One of our guys, Robert Kolb, has done one on the theology of evangelism. It's available through the Concordia Publishing House in St. Louis. K-O-L-B, Kolb. I wanted to mention an example of this. Back in the 60s, there was an InterVarsity leader by the name of Tom Stark who operated in Michigan. And he would present the gospel. Strong Calvinist, by the way.
Great.
I'll let that one pass. And he would be doing apologetics and evangelism on the university campus. And a person would get to the point in the conversation, and he would say to them, are there any other questions keeping you away from Christ and his cross? And the person would say, no, basically you've fielded them all. And he'd say, well, would you like to become a Christian? And the person would say, yes. And Tom would say, wait a minute, let me give you 10 reasons not to.
Folks, it's the White Horse Inn tonight. Mainline liberal Protestantism has lost its members because it emptied itself of its theology. The irony is that a new Protestantism is now emerging that might succeed precisely because it never had any. And that seems to be fair in the light of D.L. Moody's own comment last century. My theology, I wasn't aware I had any.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention, we have at the Concordia University in Irvine a new Master's of Arts in Reformation Theology. Now, these are not seminary courses. We're talking about a liberal arts university where the normal track would be from the master's to the Ph.D. Seminaries, you're talking about credentials for preaching and serving a parish. This is not. 90% of the students who are coming to it want to go on for their doctoral work, and this is a possibility of having a place to get ready for that Ph.D. We have visiting professors of letters.
A great list of visiting professors.
If you don't know the academic game, a Ph.D. will give you a job in no public college, but only within some denomination. The coming course I wanted to highlight was from Dr. Robert Godfrey, the church historian now president of the Westminster Seminary in Escondido, and that will begin in March. Those of you who are in the Los Angeles Basin area and would like to take a course in Calvin and Calvinism from Dr. Robert Godfrey, this is a chance of a lifetime.
It really is. He's having studied under him myself. I can vouch for that.
Yeah, this really is worth considering. If you're interested, call CURE, and CURE will pass you on to the number of Dr. Charles Mansky, who is the director of the master's program there at the Concordia University, to get information on it.
We have just a couple of seconds left. Randy in Denver, Colorado. Are you there, Randy?
Yeah. Hi, gentlemen. How you doing?
All right.
Okay.
God bless you, and may God bless you richly in all your endeavors.
Thank you.
I would like to ask two really quick questions, if I may. Number one, you speak of evangelicals as like almost in a derogatory term, and I was wondering, are you stating that evangelical believers like myself are all out on a monetary trip? And my second question is, isn't the song that you use as your I don't know what to call it, your intro song, Surfing with an Alien, wouldn't that be considered a marketing tip?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know what Surfing with an Alien is all about, but first of all, what we're not saying, this is a very important point you raise, we're not saying that evangelicals are greedy for money. That's not the point of this. What we're saying is we are selling, we as an evangelical movement, we are unfortunately selling Jesus Christ as though it were a product.
We're talking about decisions made at the elders' level.
Right.
And in many ways, you only fight with what you think really has hope. The evangelical is about the only person, a Christian person in the United States who still holds a high view of Scripture, a high view of Christ, a high view of the cross. When that degenerates, we need evangelicalism to look back to its roots, which really are in the Reformation in many cases, and do that for a culture that's dying.
Yeah, you have to understand, we're saying, we're casting Jesus in the role of a product. That's our concern. There are some people out there pocketing money and saying, oh, this is a ministry, when they're really just, you know, enjoying the profits from it. But I think most evangelicals out there on the front lines are, quote unquote, selling God, selling Jesus for the best of intentions with
exactly.
the best motives.
Right.
But they just don't realize the extent to which they are selling an American gospel.
Exactly.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.